Now we may say that going from the individual to Buddhism as a whole, taking Buddhism as the collectivity as it were of all Buddhist individuals, taking the teaching as it were as a whole, we may say that Buddhism itself balances all these five spiritual faculties. Buddhism makes provision for our devotional requirements, for our intellectual needs, our need for expression, energy, activity, and also, quite obviously, for our practice of meditation, concentration, meditation, contemplation, and so on. And of course, it makes provision for the practice, for the cultivation, for the development of mindfulness. So we may say that in the Buddhist teaching, or in the teaching of the Buddha, all these five aspects of the spiritual life are fully represented. All are there. Not only there, not just existing side by side, externally juxtaposed as it were, but integrated, harmonious. At the same time we can say that though Buddhism as a whole, it consists of various schools, various traditions, various what are sometimes called sects, even churches, though the expression isn't very appropriate in a Buddhist context. And though Buddhism as a whole represents all the five spiritual faculties, one may say that individual schools may, as it were, specialize in the cultivation, in the development of this or that faculty. Thus you have, as it were, arising in India, purely devotional schools. Schools devoted to the worship of the Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light, to the recitation of his name, to the development of faith in him, and development of the aspiration to be reborn after death in his pure land, where one will gain an opportunity of hearing the doctrine from the lips of Amitabha Buddha. So here is a school, or here is a tradition, or an aspect of Buddhism, specializing, as it were, in the devotional side. Then again in Indian Buddhism, you had a school like the Madhyamika, the school of the middle way, founded by Nagarjuna. This was, as it were, an almost exclusively intellectual school. This school studied the text, the sutras, the scriptures of perfect wisdom, of which there were very many, systematically organized the teaching of those sutras, which are of course attributed to the Buddha, and presented that teaching as it were dialectically. So here the approach was purely intellectual. Then again you had another school, say the school of the Yogacharins, who specialized in meditation, certainly in the theory of the practice of meditation, Buddhist psychology, and so on. And you had another school, like the Tantra, Tantric Buddhism, which is especially current in Tibet, which specialized, as it were, in the development of vigor or energy, especially specialized in various techniques for sublimating crude energy, psychophysical energy, into subtle, almost spiritual energy. So in this way, one had, one still has in a way, individual schools specializing, as it were, within the one main body of Buddhism in the development, in the cultivation of this or that particular spiritual faculty. So in this way, we may say, it comes about that Zen, or Chan, as it were, specializes in meditation. Amongst all the schools of Buddhism, amongst all the traditions of Buddhism, all the sects of Buddhism, if this specializes in devotion and that specializes in intellectual approach and another specializes in another approach, Zen, we may say, specializes in, devotes itself to almost exclusively the practice of Buddhist meditation. So amongst the five spiritual faculties, it is meditation, dhyana, chan, Zen, which the Zen school emphasizes and in which it specializes. So this is, as it were, introductory. This isn't, we may say, the whole story. Apart from the fact, or in addition to the fact, that it specializes in meditation, Zen has certain distinctive features. We may say that it specializes in meditation to such an extent, or up to such a point, that the specialization becomes almost an independent development. So these special characteristics of Zen also we should try to appreciate. It isn't enough to understand that Zen is simply that school of Buddhism specializing in meditation of a particular type, we should also try to understand how it specializes and try to appreciate the extent to which its specialization results in the emergence of certain quite distinctive characteristics. So in this talk, and in the ensuing talks, we shall be trying to appreciate, on the basis of a general understanding of the fact that Zen specializes in meditation, we shall be trying to appreciate some at least of these distinctive characteristics or features of the Zen school or the Zen tradition. And as we went further on to point out last week, in doing this, or in trying to do this, there are certain misunderstandings to be avoided. One might say that the air is thick with misunderstandings about Zen. One can hardly open one's mouth, one might say, on this subject without there coming out some sort of misunderstanding, some sort of misrepresentation. People think very often that because the name of Zen is very widely disseminated, therefore Zen is very well understood. But such is very far from being the case. Last week I spoke, as far as I remember, of three principal types of misunderstanding of Zen, or three ways, rather, in which misunderstandings arose, especially in the West. First of all, there's a mistake of trying to make a purely intellectual approach to Zen. All the Zen books tell you that Zen is something to be practiced, something to be experienced, something to be realized. But there are people who read these books and try to understand it all intellectually. As I said last week, I must confess in a slightly exasperated manner, there are some people who thereafter even go on to write another book themselves about Zen, on the basis of what other people have written about Zen. And in their book about Zen, they'll also tell you that Zen is something just to be experienced and realized. But they don't seem ever to get down to any actual practice, and it doesn't seem to occur to them that there's anything incongruous or contradictory or even ridiculous in their purely intellectual approach. Another source of misunderstanding is the fact that sometimes people try to get at Zen or try to approach Zen apart from Buddhism. After all, Zen is the Zen school of Buddhism. But there are some people who seem not to want to take the trouble of studying Buddhism in order to get to Zen as it were directly, right out of context, or ripping it out of context, trying to understand the leaf apart from the tree, and so on. So this is also a great mistake and a source of confusion, as well as misunderstanding. Then again, other people, as I mentioned last week, they mistake the finger for the moon. You remember the little Buddhist story about the man who pointed to the moon, pointed it out to some other person. There's the moon. So instead of looking up at the moon, the man kept looking at the finger. So this is called mistaking the finger for the moon. Mistaking the means for the end, confusing the two, getting stuck in the means, the methods, and not reaching the end, the conclusion. So people do this even in connection with Zen. They read a book about Zen, read some little story, and they read something about a master, as I said last week, giving a disciple 30 blows. Huh? It's a very well-known Zen expression, as some of you no doubt know, unfortunately. So as soon as the discussion turns to Zen, some bright spark says, oh yes, 30 blows. And then it goes on like that, like a sort of parlor game. They think that 30 blows is something to do with Zen. Or they think that the tea ceremony is something to do with Zen. Something pertaining, as it were, to the essence of it. Whereas it's all just a finger. Or all these are fingers pointing to the moon. So we're going to try to avoid all these mistakes and misunderstandings, the purely intellectual approach, trying to understand Buddhism as Zen apart from Buddhism, mistaking the finger for the moon. We're going to try to avoid all these pitfalls in our own presentation. They're all very, very common mistakes and misunderstandings in the West for various reasons. So as I said last week, we're going to try to approach Zen in the traditional way by means of, or with the help of, a traditional verse. No one knows when this verse first came into existence, or who composed it, but it roughly came into existence during the Tang Dynasty in China, and it summarizes the whole Zen teaching, the whole Zen attitude, the whole Zen approach. I read it towards the end of last week's lecture. I don't know how many people wrote it down or committed it to memory, But for the benefit of those who've forgotten it, or those to whom it may be new, let me just read it again. Description of Zen in a verse of four lines. What is Zen? A special transmission outside the scriptures. No dependence upon words and letters. Direct pointing to the heart of man, that is, or the mind of man, one can also translate it, seeing into one's own nature and attaining or realizing Buddhahood. So in this one verse of four lines, one gatha as it's called, the whole Zen teaching, approach, attitude is summarized. One might go on to say that each line deals with or embodies a fundamental principle of Zen teaching or the Zen school. So in the course of these talks, beginning as from today, we're going to take one line and one principle each week and study it, examine it, and try to delve and dig into its meaning, into its significance.